Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
This morning on the Today Show, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg said the terrorists behind 9/11 lost. New York is more vibrant than ever. But others are asking the difficult question, did Osama bin Laden actually win? Columnist Glenn Johnson writes in the Boston Globe, with the economy tanking, unemployment high, two unpaid-for wars, and Washington paralyzed and polarized, could the late leader of al-Qaeda knock the U.S. off its perch in absentia? David Gartenstein-Ross says maybe yes, but it's not too late to avoid that. He's a widely consulted expert on counterterrorism who says Osama bin Laden mistakenly believed that his fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan brought that world power to its knees when actually it was domestic problems like grain shortages and a rising deficit that knocked out the Soviets. But David says bin Laden was right in that the costs of war helped collapse the Soviet Union. And bin Laden may have been right in his thinking that the same thing is happening to the U.S. In fact, David compares the U.S. war on terror to the Muhammad Ali-George Foreman bout. David Gartenstein-Ross's new book is Bin Laden's Legacy, Why We're Still Losing the War on Terror. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to join you.
George Foreman, Muhammad Ali, 1974. Explain, what does that fight have to do with this?
Their 1974 fight was one in which George Foreman was heavily favored. He was the strongest, most powerful boxer of his generation. This was a fight in which Muhammad Ali ended up cowering against the ropes for the majority of the fight. To outside observers, when Foreman had him against the ropes and continued punching him, it appeared that George Foreman was quite handily winning. Ali, in his own turn, whispered hoarse taunts into Foreman's ears, saying, "George, you're not hitting. George, you disappoint me." The thing that the spectators didn't realize and the thing that Foreman didn't realize was that the elastic ropes were absorbing the majority of the strength of the blows. Eventually, Foreman only succeeded in tiring himself out. And in the eighth round, he was upset by Muhammad Ali, who knocked him out. The reason why this is such an important framing device within my book is it actually comes from an article published in the political science journal International Security, published just a few months before the 9/11 attacks. Entitled How the Weak Win Wars, the argument it made is that a small non-state actor such as al-Qaeda, its only hope for defeating the United States would be to replicate the Foreman-Ali boxing match where, like Muhammad Ali's rope-a-dope, which is what Ali dubbed it, you turn your enemy's strength against it. And I think when we look over the past decade, it's obvious now and will be more obvious as more time goes by that that essentially was what al-Qaeda's strategy had evolved into, and we allowed it to happen.
And you have quotes from Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, quotes like, "We want to continue this policy of bleeding America to the point of bankruptcy." The point is that they felt through, another way they put it, 1,000 cuts, they could provoke the U.S. into reacting and spending money.
Right. He gave an interview in October 2001 with an Al Jazeera journalist named Taysir Alouni, in which when he talked about what he accomplished through 9/11, the very first thing he talked about was the economic consequences of the attack. Now, after the 9/11 attacks, of course, the United States went into Afghanistan, but then thinking that al-Qaeda had been defeated there, ended up drawing resources away from Afghanistan and Pakistan and towards Iraq for the very ill-fated invasion of Iraq. There are other adaptations that this strategy went through, but one of the most significant recent ones that occurred after the September 2008 collapse of the financial sector is exactly what you refer to, what they have called the strategy of 1,000 cuts. Their perception is that this financial crisis makes the United States mortal. And as such, with this weakened America, smaller attacks that are designed to drive up security costs can be an effective tool, in their view, of carrying out asymmetric warfare against the U.S.
So, for instance, the plot to hide bombs in ink cartridges and get those aboard cargo planes, FedEx, UPS, it was applauded here in the U.S. when those plots were stopped. But you point out that to al-Qaeda, stopping the plot isn't the point. You refer to an issue of the online al-Qaeda magazine Inspire. On the cover, it shows a UPS plane and the headline, $4,200. What was the al-Qaeda take on what happened?
Their take is that $4,200 is all that the attack cost them. And there's this major disjuncture between what the plot cost them, even though it didn't succeed, and what it will cost al-Qaeda's enemies to defend against a repeat of this in the future.
And I'm referring to the chart that outlines that in your book. The cost to jihadi groups, $4,200. The cost to the victims, the U.S., $17 million in security. The Christmas Day bombing, the failed underpants bomber, the cost to the jihadi groups, $7,000. The cost to the U.S. in increased security, $1.2 billion every year. Times Square plot, approximately $2,000. Cost to ramp up security after that, $200 million.
Right. And I should point out also, this is only the direct cost attributable to each and every attack. When you look at the costs of 9/11, one also has to look at the mushrooming of intelligence agencies, Homeland Security agencies, the contractors who were brought on. The ramping up entailed a tremendous expenditure of resources.
Well, David Gartenstein-Ross, again, his book, Bin Laden's Legacy, Why We're Still Losing the War on Terror. Yesterday, we spoke with a professor from Brown University's Watson Institute. She quoted, as you do, the cost of trillions of dollars for the two ongoing wars. And you write as well about not only the huge security apparatus built in the U.S., but the misuse of it. You give one example, the president of a firm who was awarded a no-bid contract to book hotels and paid herself $5.4 million for 9 months of work. Dana Priest at The Post found 1,271 government programs and 1,931 private companies working on counterterrorism, security, and intelligence as of 2010. The huge cost of all of that. But after our segment on the cost of the wars, we heard from listener Greg Camp, who said, well, what's the cost of not acting? What's the cost of allowing a nation, Afghanistan, to harbor terrorists?
Look, this is how I would frame it. Obviously, we had to act. That doesn't mean that the actions we took are the right ones. Right now, there's this debate going on, which I'm involved in, about whether the U.S. is safer a decade after the 9/11 attacks. And I find myself very much in the minority, which isn't a bad place to be given how often conventional wisdom has been wrong over the course of the past decade. I think that the United States is not safer when you look at safety as a product of our capabilities to defend ourselves against attack and our resilience versus the capabilities of our opponent. A safer world would be one in which United States power overall, United States capabilities and resilience are similar to what they were a decade ago when we were the world's undisputed superpower, when we were actually paying off our debt as opposed to having the massive national debt that we have now. I mean, it's not due entirely to the war on terror by any means. Things like the subprime mortgage crisis, that cannot be attributed to al-Qaeda, although I think the spending we had on Iraq and other security measures helped to deepen the impact when that crisis finally hit. What I would have liked to seen over the past decade is the U.S. doing a better job of conserving its resources, because power derives from resources that you've conserved rather than resources that you expend all at once, often with nebulous gains.
We're speaking with terrorism consultant and author David Gartenstein-Ross. His new book, Bin Laden's Legacy, Why We're Still Losing the War on Terror. Now, Fareed Zakaria and others have said the death of Osama bin Laden, along with the Arab Spring, signaled the end of al-Qaeda. But David says if the Arab Spring raises too many expectations, it may prove fertile ground for new recruits. But also, he argues, the U.S. never understood its foe and built a bloated bureaucracy to fight it and now needs to switch to more agile tactics, like the new airport profiling, where agents have conversations with passengers to pick up behaviors. He also says the U.S. has to address the politicization of national security, politicians spending large amounts of money as a proxy for toughness. And David, you also suggest that a group of moderates somehow be pulled together as sort of a commission to review security issues. Moderates? You know, is that wishful thinking?
It may be wishful thinking. I think it's a bit more realistic than some give it credit for. It's something I've fleshed out with people I know within the private sector. I think this would ultimately be a public-private partnership. The purpose would be to have a forum where experts can talk to the administration about what the key issues are. And so people understand what's on the agenda, how is the administration seeing it, moving towards a more reasoned and kind of centered discourse. Now, I agree, this may not work, particularly given how easy it is for a sensational claim to end up dominating the news cycle. It's something that may well fail, but I think it's worth trying alternative models to try to empower in public discourse voices that aren't going to exaggerate a subject so that we can get better policy over the long term.
In the same line of thinking, you say there needs to be civil service reform, get, you know, the ability to get rid of federal workers who might do that same politicization. But the most chilling thing maybe that you say is that you speak to several experts in security, and here's one from the Institute for Alternative Futures, who say that politicians have to better communicate to the public that we have limited resources, that one or two attacks may get through, that a zero tolerance for attacks policy is not only unrealistic, but it doesn't then prepare a society that's resilient enough to absorb an attack. That's your other conclusion, that we have to build resilience.
Yes. And I wish there were a cheerier conclusion there. But at the end of the day, the past decade, I think, has been one where both we channeled a great deal of resources to this problem, certainly overspending on it, but where we also got lucky. There are several attacks where, had things gone just a little bit differently, the body count over the past decade would look much differently. Times Square is one example. If you'd had a bomb that was built right, then Faisal Shahzad would have killed a number of people. This is the reality that we live in. If you're an enemy attacking, all you need to do is get lucky once.
Well, but what do you mean by, do you think that somehow Americans' resilience has been somehow diminished by being told that there will be zero toleration for attacks? What do you mean by we need to build resilience? Americans think of themselves as pretty resilient.
I think Americans are much more resilient than politicians consider them to be. Studies that have been done on this, such as by Ben Shepherd, who you mentioned in your comments, conclude that when people, not just Americans, but when people are faced with a significant threat of terrorism, they tend to be more psychologically resilient than conventional wisdom suggests. One thing I often hear when I say, look, we're spending too much money in the field of counterterrorism, is Americans could not handle another attack. The assumption is that Americans aren't resilient enough. There'd be a huge political backlash. I think that communication that's frank on these issues, and in particular, preparing people to play a constructive role, that's something which is very empowering and also actually makes us more effective in the face of a potential attack or in the face of a potential disaster.
You write about the Community Emergency Response Team, CERT, which is developed by the Los Angeles Fire Department and is used by other cities. And it trains people to respond. And it, not only does it train them physically and tactically, but then, as you say, emotionally.
Right. And I think that the more we understand that we can care for ourselves, the better off we are. And in an age of austerity, which is the age that we're entering right now, there are going to be a lot of cutbacks at the federal level. Better empowering people to take care of their own communities and building resilience in that way is, I think, an important part of making us a robust nation that can handle the kind of problems that are going to confront it.
David, quick question. When doing some research, we read that the original title was going to be Why Al-Qaeda is Winning. Was there something psychological, emotional there that you wanted to maybe tamp down? This is a very disturbing thought, and this week in particular.
That's a good question. Bin Laden's death had actually drove the final nail into the coffin for that title. Booksellers and others were asking, is this book now irrelevant? And the book is very much a post-Bin Laden book. But the argument has really been largely unchanged. One thing I should say, when we look at Al-Qaeda as a network, I significantly question how important taking out a leader is. I think it's had a significant disruptive impact on Al-Qaeda since May. But a networked organization can end up rejuvenating itself. Right now, we may see a bit of an overestimate of Al-Qaeda's weakness, just as in the past we've seen a bit of an overestimate of Al-Qaeda's strength.
Well, it's just a hard thing to hear that Osama bin Laden may have in many ways won. I'm just wondering about the emotional response to that.
I agree with that as well. It raises the question of, what do we do about it now? In some ways, it's difficult to answer the question of, are we safer over the past decade? Because, we had to do some things over the course of the past decade to deal with the terrorist threat. I fully believe that. But you get into the broader question of where we are as a country. And when you look at it through that lens, sadly, the picture looks less good. I think it's important to fashion sound policies for the next decade of protecting ourselves against violent non-state actors. Because if we don't have them, and if I am right about the corrosive effect that many of these overarching policies have had, then we'll be at a state where things may well get worse.
David Gartenstein-Ross, again, the book is Bin Laden's Legacy, Why We're Still Losing the War on Terror. David, thank you.
It was a pleasure joining you.